Is it? What?
They found out, she said. Her eyes were glazed like old Shizian porcelain. Somehow, the bastards found out. The gate creaked open again, and petals of early autumn vine flowers, blue and purple, came dancing over the college wall. They hung and stepped like butterflies and fell slowly, as three caped policemen and a doctor in a dark cap emerged carrying a stretcher. A red blanket had covered the patient, but the wind that tossed the petals caught a corner of the blanket and pulled it back in a triangular fold. The girls all shrieked, and Amma Vimp ran forward to tuck the blanket down. But in the sunlight, all had looked down and seen the twisted shoulders and back-thrown head of Dr. Dillamond. His throat was still knotted with congealed ropes of black blood, where it had been slit as thoroughly as if he had wandered into an abattoir. Bach sat down, disgusted and alarmed, hoping he had not seen death, just a horrible, treatable wound. But the police and doctor weren't hurrying. There was no reason to hurry now. Bach fell back against the wall, and Averick, who had never seen the goat before, held Bach's hands tightly with one hand and covered his own face with the other. Before long, Galinda and Elphaba sank down beside him, and there was some weeping, some long weeping, before words could be spoken. At last, Galinda told the story. "We went to bed last night, and Amma Clutch got up to pull the drapes closed, as she does. And she looks down and says almost to herself, 'Well, there's the lights on. Dr. Goat is at it again.' Then she peers a little closer down the yard and says, 'Well, now, isn't that funny?' And I don't pay any attention. I'm just sitting there staring. But Elphaba says, 'What's funny, Amma Clutch?' And Amma Clutch just pulls the drape very tightly and says in a funny voice, 'Oh, nothing, my ducks. I'll just step down to check and make sure everything's all right, as long as you girls are abed.' She says good night, and she leaves, and I don't know if she goes down there or what, but we both fall asleep, and in the morning she isn't there with the tea. She always gets the tea. She always does." Galinda gave herself to tears, sinking and then raising herself to her knees and trying to tear her black silk gown with the white epaulets and the white bobbing. Elphaba, dry-eyed as a desert stone, continued. "We waited until after breakfast, but then we went to Madame Morrible's," said Elphaba, "and told her that we didn't know where Amma Clutch was. And Madame Morrible said that Amma Clutch had had a relapse during the night and was recovering in the infirmary. She wouldn't let us in to see her at first, but then when Dr. Dillamond didn't show up for our first lecture of the semester, we wandered over there and just pushed our way in. Amma Clutch was in a hospital bed. Her face looked funny, like the last pancake of the batch, the way it goes all wrong. We said, 'Amma Clutch, Amma Clutch, what has happened to you?' She didn't say anything, even though her eyes were open. She didn't seem to hear us. We thought maybe she was asleep or in shock, but her breathing was regular, and her color was good, even though her face seemed awry. Then, as we were leaving, she turned and she looked at the bedside table. Next to a medicine bottle and a cup of lemon water, there was a long rusty nail on a silver tray. She reached a shaky hand out to the nail and picked it up and held it in her palm tenderly, and she talked to it. She said something like, 'Oh, well then, I know you didn't mean to stab my foot last year. You were only trying to get my attention. That's what misbehavior is all about, just a little extra loving being asked for. Well, don't you worry, Nail, because I'm going to love you just as much as you need. and after I have a little nap, you can tell me how you came to be holding up the platform of the railway station at Frotica, for it seems quite a leap from your early years as a common hook for a closed-for-the-season sign in that dingy hotel you were talking about." But Bach could not listen to this blather. He could not take in the story of a live nail while a dead goat was being prayed over by hysterical faculty members. Bach could not listen to the sounds of the prayers for the repose of the animal spirit. He could not watch the departure of the corpse when they trundled it away. For it had been clear, with a glimpse of the goat's still face, that whatever had given the doctor his enlivening character had already disappeared. The Charmed Circle. There was no doubt in the minds of anyone who had seen the corpse that the word, the correct word, was murder. The way the pelt about the neck had bunched up, caked together like an improperly cleaned worker's paintbrush, the raw amber hollow in the eye. The official story was that the doctor had broken a magnifying lens and stumbled against it, cutting an artery in the process, but nobody believed it. The only one they could think of to ask, Amma Klotsch, merely smiled when they came to visit, with handfuls of pretty yellowing leaves or a plate of late Pertha grapes. She devoured the grapes and chatted with the leaves. It was an ailment no one had ever seen before. Glinda, for out of some belated apology for her initial rudeness to the martyred goat, she now called herself as he had once called her, Glinda, seemed to be stricken dumb before the fact of Amma Klotsch. Glinda wouldn't visit, nor discuss the poor woman's condition. So Elphaba sneaked in once or twice a day. Bach assumed that Amma Klotsch suffered a passing malady. But after 3 weeks, Madame Morrible began to make sounds of concern that Elphaba and Glinda, still roomies, had no chaperone. She suggested the common dormitory for them both. Glinda, who would no longer go to see Madame Morrible on her own, nodded and accepted the demotion. It was Elphaba who came up with a solution, mostly to salvage some shred of Glinda's dignity. Thus it was that 10 days later Bach found himself in the beer garden of the Cock and Pumpkins, waiting for the midweek coach from the Emerald City. Madame Morrible didn't allow Elphaba and Glinda to join him, so he had to decide for himself which two of the 7 passengers alighting were Nanny and Nessa Rose. The deformities of Elphaba's sister were well concealed, Elphaba had warned him. Nessa Rose could even descend from a carriage with grace, providing the step was secure and the ground flat. He met them, said hello. Nanny was a stewed plum of a woman, red and loose, her old skin looking ready to trail off but for the tucks at the corners of the mouth, the fleshy rivets by the edges of the eyes. More than a score of years in the Badlands of Quadling Country had made her lethargic, careless, and saturated with resentment. At her age, she ought to have been allowed to nod off in some warm chimney nook. "Good to see a little Munchkinlander," she murmured to Bach. "It's like the old times." Then she turned and said into the shadows, "Come, my puppet." Had he not been warned, Bach wouldn't have taken Nessa Rose as Elphaba's sister. She was by no means green, or even blue-white, like a genteel person with bad circulation. Nessa Rose stepped from the carriage elegantly, gingerly, strangely, sinking her heel to touch the iron step at the same time as her toe. Walking as oddly as she did, she drew attention to her feet, which kept eyes away from the torso, at least at first. The feet landed on the ground, driven there with a ferocious intention to balance. And Nessa Rose stood before him. She was, as Elphaba had said, gorgeous, pink, slender as a wheat stalk, and armless. The academic shawl over her shoulder was cunningly folded to soften the shock. "Hello, good sir," she said, nodding her head very slightly. "The valises are on top. Can you manage?" Her voice was as smooth and oiled as Elphaba's was serrated. Nanny propelled Nessa Rose gently toward the hansom cab that Bock had engaged. He saw that Nessa Rose did not move well without being able to lean backward against a steadying hand. "So, now Nanny has to see the girls through their schooling," said Nanny to Bock as they rode along. "What with their sainted mother in her waterlogged grave these long years, and their father off his head. Well, the family always was bright, and brightness, as you know, decays brilliantly. Madness is the most shining way. The elderly man, the eminent Throp, he's still alive, and sensible as an old plowshare. Survived his daughter and his granddaughter. Elphaba is the Throp third descending. She'll be the eminence one day. As a Munchkinlander, you know about such things." "Nanny, don't gossip. It hurts my soul," Nessa Rose said. "Oh, my pretty, don't you fret. This Bock is an old friend, or as good as," said Nanny. "Out in the swamps of Quaddling Hell, my friend, we've lost the art of conversation. We croak in chorus with what's left of the froggy folk." "I intend to have a headache from shame," said Nessa Rose charmingly.
"But I knew Elfie when she was a small thing," said Bock. "I'm from Rush Margins in Wend Hardings. I must have met you, too."
"Primarily, I preferred to reside at Colwyn Grounds," said Nanny. "I was a mortal comfort to the Lady Partra, the Throp second descending. But occasionally I visited Rush Margins, so I may have met you when you were young enough to run around without trousers."
"How do you do?" said Nessa Rose.
"The name is Bock," said Bock. "This is Nessa Rose," said Nanny, as if it were too painful for the girl to introduce herself. "She was to come up to Shiz next year, but we have learned there's a problem with some Gillikinese minder going loopy. So Nanny is called to step in, and can Nanny leave her suite? You see why not."
"A sad mystery. We hope for improvement," said Bock.
At Craige Hall, Bock witnessed the reunion of the sisters, which was warm and gratifying. Madame Morrible had her grammatic thing wheel out tea and brisks for the Throp females, and for Nanny, Bock, and Glinda. Bock, who had begun to worry about Glinda's retreat into silence, was relieved to see Glinda cast a hard, appraising eye over the elegant dress of Nessa Rose. How could it be, he wondered if Glinda was wondering, that two sisters should each be disfigured and should clothe themselves so unlike? Elphaba wore the humblest of dark frocks. Today she was in a deep purple, almost a black. Nessa Rose, balanced on a sofa next to Nanny, who assisted by lifting teacups and crumpling buttery bits of crumpet, was in green silks, the colours of moss, emerald, and yellow-green roses. Green Elphaba, sitting on her other side and lending her support between the shoulders as she tilted her head back to sip her tea, looked like a fashion accessory.
"The whole arrangement is highly unusual," Madame Morrible was saying. "But we don't have unlimited room to accommodate peculiarities, alas. We'll leave Miss Elphaba and Miss Glinda. Glinda, is it now, dear? How novel. We'll leave those two old pals as they are, and we'll set you up, Miss Nessa Rose, with your Nanny in the adjoining room that poor old Amma Clutch had.
It's small, but you must think of it as cozy.
But when Amma Klatch recovers? Asked Glinda.
Oh, but my dear, said Madame Horrible, such confidence the young have. Touching, really.
She continued in a more steely voice.
You have already told me of the long-standing recurrence of this unusual medical condition. I can only assume this has deteriorated into a permanent relapse.
She munched a biscuit in her slow, fishy way, her cheeks going in and out like the leather flaps of a bellows.
Of course, we can all hope. Not much more than that, I'm afraid.
And we can pray, Nessa Rose said.
Oh, well, yes, that, said the head. That goes without saying among people of good breeding, Miss Nessa Rose.
Bach watched Nessa Rose and Elphaba both blush. Glinda excused herself and went away. The usual pang of panic Bach felt at her departure was softened by knowing he would see her again in life sciences next week, for with the new prohibitions on animal hiring, the colleges had decided to give assembly lectures to all the students from all the colleges at once. Bach would see Glinda at the first co-education lecture ever held at Shiz. He couldn't wait. Though she had changed. She had surely changed. Glinda was changed. She knew it herself. She had come to Shiz a vain, silly thing, and she now found herself in a coven of vipers. Maybe it was her own fault. She had invented a nonsense disease for Amma Klatch, and Amma Klatch had come down with it. Was this proof of an inherent talent of sorcery? Glinda opted to specialize in sorcery this year and accepted it as her punishment that Madame Morrible didn't change her roomie as promised. Glinda no longer cared. Beside Dr. Dillamond's death, a lot of other matters now seemed insignificant. But she didn't trust Madame Morrible either. Glinda had told nobody else that stupid and extravagant lie, so now she would no longer allow Madame Morrible so much as a finger-hold into her life. And Glinda still didn't have the nerve to confess her unintentional crime to anyone. While she fretted, Bach, that pesky little flea, kept zizzing around her looking for attention. She was sorry she had let him kiss her. What a mistake! Well, all that was behind her now, that trembling on the edges of social disaster. She had seen the Mrs. Fernet, etc., for what they were, shallow, self-serving snobs, and she would have no more to do with them. So Elphaba, no longer a social liability, had all the potential of becoming an actual friend. If being saddled with this broken doll of a baby sister didn't interfere too much. It was only with prodding that Glinda had gotten Elphaba to talk at all about her sister, so that Glinda might be prepared for Nessa Rose's arrival and the enlargement of their social circle. She was born at Colwyn Grounds when I was about 3, Elphaba had told her. My family had gone back to Colwyn Grounds for a short stay. It was one of those times of intense drought. Our father told us later, after our mother had died, that Nessa Rose's birth had coincided with a temporary resurgence of well water in the vicinity. They'd been doing pagan dances, and there was a human sacrifice. Glinda had stared at Elphaba, who sounded at once unwilling and offhand. A friend of theirs, a quaddling glassblower. The crowd, incited by some rabble-rousing faithers and a prophetic clock, fell on him and killed him. A man named Turtleheart. Elphaba had pressed the palms of her hands over the high uppers of her stiff black second-hand shoes and kept her eyes trained on the floor.
I think that was why my parents became missionaries to the Quadling people, why they never went back to Colwyn Grounds or Munchkin Land.
"But your mother died in childbirth," said Glinda. "How could she have been a missionary?"
"She didn't die for 5 years," said Elphaba, looking at the folds of her dress, as if the story were an embarrassment. "She died when our younger brother was born. My father named him Shell, after Turtleheart, I think. So Shell and Nessa Rose and I lived the lives of gypsy children, slopping around from Quadling settlement to settlement with Nanny and our father, Frex. He preached, and Nanny taught us and raised us up, and kept house such as we ever had, which wasn't much. Meanwhile, the wizard's men began draining the Badlands to get at the ruby deposits. It never worked, of course. They managed to chase the Quadlings out and kill them, round them up in settlement camps for their own protection, and starve them. They despoiled the Badlands, raked up the rubies, and left. My father went balmy over it. There never were enough rubies to make it worth the effort. We still have no canal system to run that legendary water from the Vincas all the way cross-country to Munchkin Land. And the drought, after a few promising reprieves, continues unabated. The animals are recalled to the lands of their ancestors, a ploy to give the farmers a sense of control over something, anyway. It's a systematic marginalizing of populations, Glinda. That's what the wizard's all about."
"We were talking about your childhood," said Glinda.
"Well, that's it. That's all part of it. You can't divorce your particulars from politics," Elphaba said. "You want to know what we ate? How we played?"
"I want to know what Nessa Rose is like, and Shell," said Glinda.
"Nessa Rose is a strong-willed semi-invalid," said Elphaba. "She's very smart, and thinks she is holy. She has inherited my father's taste for religion. She isn't good at taking care of other people, because she has never learned how to take care of herself. She can't. My father required me to babysit her through most of my childhood. What she will do when Nanny dies, I don't know. I suppose I'll have to take care of her again."
"Oh, what a hideous prospect for a life," said Glinda, before she could stop herself.
But Elphaba only nodded grimly. "I can't agree with you more," she said.
"As for Shell," continued Glinda, wondering what fresh pain she might tread upon.
"Male and white and whole," she said. "He's now about 10, I guess. He'll stay at home and take care of our father. He is a boy, just as boys are. A little dull, maybe, but he hasn't had the advantages we've had."
"Which are?" prompted Glinda.
"Even for a short time," said Elphaba, "we had a mother. Giddy, alcoholic, imaginative, uncertain, desperate, brave, stubborn, supportive woman. We had her, Melina. Shell had no mother but Nanny, who did her best."
"And who was your mother's favorite?" said Glinda.
"Can't tell that," said Elphaba casually. "Don't know. Would have been Shell, probably, since he's a boy. But she died without seeing him, so she didn't even get that small consolation."
"Your father's favorite?"
"Oh, that's easy," said Elphaba, jumping up and finding her books on her shelf, and getting ready to run out and stop the conversation in its tracks. "That's Nessa Rose. You'll see why when you meet her. She'd be anyone's favorite."
She skidded out of the room with no more than a brief flurry of green fingers, a goodbye. Glinda wasn't so sure she favored Elphaba's sister. Nessa Rose seemed so demanding. Nanny was overly attentive, and Elphaba kept suggesting adjustments in their living arrangements to make things perfect. Hitch the drapes to this angle instead of that, to keep the touch of the sun off Nessa Rose's pretty skin.
Can we have the oil lamp turned up high so Nesseros can read?
Shh! No chatting after hours.
Nesseros has retired, and she is such a light sleeper. Glinda was a bit awed by Nesseros's freaky beauty. Nesseros dressed well, if not extravagantly. She deflected attention from herself, though, by a system of little social tics. The head lowered in a sudden onslaught of devotion, the eyes batting. It was especially moving and irritating to have to wipe away a trickle of tears brought on by some epiphany in Nesseros's rich inner spiritual life of which bystanders could have no inkling. What did one say? Glinda began to retreat into her studies. Sorcery was being taught by a louche new instructor named Miss Grayling. She had a gushing respect for the subject, but it soon became apparent little natural ability.
"At its most elemental, a spell is no more than a recipe for change," she would flute at them.
But when the chicken she tried to turn into a piece of toast became instead a mess of used coffee grounds, cupped in a lettuce leaf, the students all made a mental note never to accept an invitation to dine with her. In the back of the room, creeping with pretend invisibility so that she might observe, Madame Morrible shook her head and clucked. Once or twice, she could not stop herself from interfering.
"No dab hand in the sorcerer's parlor, I," she would protest. "Yet surely, Miss Grayling, you've omitted the steps to bind and convince? I'm merely asking. Let me try. You know I take a special pleasure in our training of sorceresses."
Inevitably, Miss Grayling sat on what was left of a previous demonstration, or dropped her purse, collapsing into a heap of shame and mortification. The girls giggled and didn't feel that they were learning much. Or were they? The benefit of Miss Grayling's clumsiness was that they were not afraid to try for themselves. And she didn't stint at enthusiasm if a student managed to accomplish the day's task. The first time Glinda was able to mask a spool of thread with a spell of invisibility, even for a few seconds, Miss Grayling clapped her hands and jumped up and down and broke a heel off her shoe. It was gratifying and encouraging. "Not that I have any objection," said Elphaba one day, when she and Glinda and Nesseros, and inevitably Nanny, sat under a pearl-fruit tree by the suicide canal. "But I have to wonder, how does the university get away with teaching sorcery when its original charter was so strictly unionist?" "Well, there isn't anything inherently either religious or non-religious about sorcery," said Glinda. "Is there?" "There isn't anything inherently pleasure-faithist about it, either. Spells, changings, apparitions, it's all entertainment," said Elphaba. "It's theatre."
"Well, it can look like theatre, and in the hands of Miss Grayling it often looks like bad theatre," admitted Glinda.
"But the gist of it isn't concerned with application. It's a practical skill, like reading and writing. It's not that you can, it's what you read or write, or if you'll excuse the play on words, what you spell."
"Father disapproved mightily," Nesseros said in the dulcet tones of the unflappably faithful. "Father always said that magic was the sleight of hand of the devil. He said pleasure faith was no more than an exercise to distract the masses from the true object of their devotion."
"That's a unionist talking," said Glinda, not taking offense. "A sensible opinion, if what you're up against is charlatans or street performers.
But sorcery doesn't have to be that. What about the common witches up in the Glicus? They say that they magic the cows they've imported from Munchkin Land so they don't go mooing over the edge of some precipice. Who could ever afford to put a fence on every ledge there? The magic is a local skill,
a contribution to community well-being. It doesn't have to supplant religion.
It may not have to, said Nessa Rose, but if it tends to, then have we a duty to be wary of it?
Oh, wary? Well, I'm wary of the water I drink. It might be poisoned, said Glinda. That doesn't mean I stop drinking water.
Well, I don't think it's so big an issue, said Elphaba. I think sorcery is trivial. It's concerned with itself, mostly. It doesn't lead outward.
Glinda concentrated very hard and tried to make Elphaba's leftover sandwich elevate outward over the canal. She only succeeded in exploding the thing in a small combustion of mayonnaise and shredded carrot and chopped olives.
Nessa Rose lost her balance laughing, and Nanny had to prop her up again.
Elphaba was covered in bits of food, which she picked off herself and ate, to the disgust and laughter of everyone else.
"It's all effects, Glinda," she said. "There's nothing ontologically interesting about magic. Not that I believe in unionism, either," she protested. "I'm an atheist and an a-spiritualist."
"You say that to shock and scandalize," said Nessa Rose primly. "Glinda, don't listen to a word of her. She always does this, usually to make Father irate."
"Father's not around," Elphaba reminded her sister.
"I stand in for him, and I am offended," said Nessa Rose. "It's all very well to turn your nose up at unionism when you have been given a nose by the unnamed god. It's quite funny, isn't it, Glinda?"
"Childish."
She looked spitting angry.
"Father's not around," said Elphaba again, in a tone that verged on the apologetic.
"You needn't rush to public defense of his obsessions."
"What you term his obsessions are my articles of faith," she said with a chilly clarity.
"Well, you're not a bad sorceress for a beginner," said Elphaba, turning to Glinda. "That was a pretty good mess you made of my lunch."
"Thank you," Glinda said. "I didn't mean to pelt you with it, but I am getting better, aren't I? And out in public."
"A shocking display," Nessa Rose said. "That's exactly what Father would have deplored about sorcery. The allure is all in the surface."
"I agree. It still tastes like olives," Elphaba said, finding a clump of black olive in her sleeve and holding it out on the tip of her finger to her sister's mouth.
"Taste, Nessa?"
But Nessa Rose turned her face away and lost herself in silent prayer.
A few days later, Bach managed to catch Elphaba's eye at the break of their life sciences class, and they met up in an alcove off the main corridor.
"What do you think of this new Dr. Nicodick?" he asked.
"I find it hard to listen," she said, "but that's because I still want to hear Dr. Dillamond, and I can't believe he's gone."
On her face was a look of gray submission to impossible reality.
"Well, that's one of the things I'm curious about," he said. "You told me all about Dr. Dillamond's breakthrough. Do you know if his lab has been cleared out yet? Maybe there's something there worth finding out. You took the notes for him. Couldn't they be the basis of some proposal, or at least some further study?"
She looked at him with a wiry, strong expression.
"Do you think I'm not way ahead of you?" she asked. "Of course I went tramping through there the day his body was found, before anyone could lace up the door with padlocks and binding spells. Bach, do you take me for a fool?"
"No, I don't take you for a fool, so tell me what you found," he said.
"His findings are well hidden away," she said, "and though there are colossal holes in my training, I am studying it on my own."
"You mean you're not going to show me?"
He was shocked.
"It was never your particular interest," she said. "Besides, until there's something to prove, what's the point? I don't think Dr. Dillamond was there yet."
"I am a Munchkinlander," he answered proudly.
"Look, Elfie, you've more or less convinced me what the wizard is up to. The confining of animals back onto farms to give the dissatisfied Munchkinlander farmers the impression he's doing something for them, and also to provide forced labor for the sinking of useless new wells. It's vile. But this affects Wend Hardings and the towns that sent me here. I have a right to know what you know. Maybe we can figure it out together, work to make a change." "You have too much to lose," she said. "I'm going to take this on myself."
"Take what on?"
She only shook her head. "The less you know, the better, and I mean for your sake. Whoever killed Dr. Dillamond doesn't want his findings made public. What kind of a friend would I be to you if I put you at risk, too?"
"What kind of friend would I be to you if I didn't insist?" he retorted.
But she wouldn't tell him. When he sat next to her during the rest of the class and passed her little notes, she ignored them all. Later he thought that they might have developed a genuine impasse in their friendship had the odd attack on the newcomer not occurred during that very session. Dr. Nikodik had been lecturing on the life force, and twining around each wrist the two separate tendrils of his long, straggly beard, he spoke in falling tones so that only the first half of each sentence made it to the back of the room. Hardly a single student was following. When Dr. Nikodik took a small bottle from his vest pocket and mumbled something about "extract of biological intention," only the students in the front row sat up and opened their eyes. For Bach and Elphaba and everyone else, the patter ran,
"A little sauce for the soup, mumble, mumble. As if creation were an unconcluded mumble, mumble, mumble. Notwithstanding the obligations of all sentient mumble, mumble, mumble. And so as a little exercise to make those nodding off in the back of the mumble, mumble, mumble. Behold a little mundane miracle, courtesy of mumble, mumble, mumble."
A frisson of excitement had woken everyone up. The doctor uncorked the smoky bottle and made a jerky movement. They could all see a small puff of dust, like an effervescence of talcum powder, jostle itself in a swimming plume in the air above the neck of the bottle. The doctor rode his hands a couple of times to start the air currents eddying upward. Keeping some rare sort of spatial coherence, the plume began to migrate upward and over. The oohs that the students were inclined to make were all postponed. Dr. Nikodik held a finger out to them to shush them, and they could tell why. A vast intake of breath would change the pattern of air currents and divert the floating musk of powder. But the students began to smile despite themselves. Above the stage, amid the standard ceremonial stag's horns and brass trumpets on braid, hung four oil portraits of the founding fathers of Ozma Towers. In their ancient garb and serious expressions, they looked down on today's students. If this biological intention were to be applied to one of the founding fathers, what would he say, seeing men and women students together in the great hall? What would he have to say about anything? It was a grand moment of anticipation. But when a door to the side of the stage opened, the mechanics of the air currents were disturbed. A student looked in, puzzled. A new student, oddly dressed in suede leggings and a white cotton shirt, with a pattern of blue diamonds tattooed on the dark skin of his face and hands. No one had seen him before, or anyone like him. Bach clutched Elphaba's hand tightly and whispered, "Look! A Winky!" And so it seemed, a student from the Vincus, in strange ceremonial garb, coming late for class, opening the wrong door,
confused and apologetic, but the door had shut behind him and locked from this side, and there were no nearby seats available in the front rows. So he dropped where he was and sat with his back against the door, hoping, no doubt, to look inconspicuous.
"Drat and damn, the thing's been shabbed off course," said Dr. Nikodik. "You fool! Why don't you come to class on time?"
The shining mist, about the size of a bouquet of flowers, had veered upward in a draft, and it bypassed the ranks of long-dead dignitaries, waiting an unexpected chance to speak again. Instead, it cloaked one of the racks of antlers, seeming for a few moments to hang itself on the twisting prongs.
"Well, I can scarcely hope to hear a word of wisdom from them, and I refuse to waste any more of this precious commodity on classroom demonstrations," said Dr. Nikodik. "The research is still incomplete, and I had thought that mumble, mumble, mumble. Let you discover for yourselves if mumble, mumble, mumble. I should hardly wish to prejudice your mumble."
The antlers suddenly took a convulsive twist on the wall and wrenched themselves out of the oaken paneling. They tumbled and clattered to the floor, to the shrieking and laughing of the students, especially because, for a minute, Dr. Nikodik didn't know what the uproar was about. He turned around in time to see the antlers right themselves and wait, quivering, twitching on the dais, like a fighting cock all nastied up and ready to go into the ring.
"Oh, well, don't look at me," said Dr. Nikodik, collecting his books. "I didn't ask for anything from you. Blame that one if you must."
And he casually pointed at the Vinca student, who was cowering so wide-eyed that the more cynical of the older students began to suspect this was all a set-up. The antlers stood on their points and skittered crab-like across the stage. As the students rose in a common scream, the antlers scrabbled up the body of the Vinca's boy and pinned him against the locked door. One wing of the rack caught him by the neck, shackling him in its V-yoke, and the other reared back in the air to stab him in the face. Dr. Nikodik tried to move fast and fell to his arthritic knees. But before he could right himself, two boys were up on the stage, out of the front row, grabbing the antlers and wrestling them to the ground. The Vinca's boy shrieked in a foreign tongue. "That's Crope and Tibbet," said Bok, jouncing Elphaba in the shoulder. "Look!" The sorcery students were all jumping on their seats and trying to lob spells at the murderous antlers, and Crope and Tibbet found their grips and lost them and found them again, until at last they succeeded in breaking off one driving tine, then another, and the pieces, still twitching, fell to the stage floor without further momentum. "Oh, the poor guy," said Bok, for the Vinca student had slumped down and was volubly weeping behind his blue diamonded hands. "I never saw a student from the Vincas before. What an awful welcome to Shiz." The attack on the Vinca student provoked gossip and speculation. In sorcery the next day, Glinda asked Miss Grayling to explain something. How could Dr. Nikodik's extract of biological intention, or whatever it was, how could it fall under the heading of life sciences when it behaved like a master spell? What really is the difference between science and sorcery? "Ah," said Miss Grayling, choosing this moment to apply herself to the care of her hair. "Science, my dears, is the systematic dissection of nature to reduce it to working parts that more or less obey universal laws. Sorcery moves in the opposite direction. It doesn't rend, it repairs. It is synthesis rather than analysis. It builds anew rather than revealing the old. In the hands of someone truly skilled,
At this she jabbed herself with a hairpin and yelped. "It is art. One might in fact call it the superior or the finest art. It bypasses the fine arts of painting and drama and recitation. It doesn't pose or represent the world. It becomes a very noble calling." She began to weep softly with the force of her own rhetoric. "Can there be a higher desire than to change the world? Not to draw utopian blueprints, but really to order change? To revise the misshapen, reshape the mistaken, to justify the margins of this ragged error of a universe? Through sorcery to survive?" At tea time, still awed and amused, Glinda reported Miss Grayling's little heartfelt speech to the two Thropp sisters. Nessa Rose said, "Only the unnamed God creates, Glinda. If Miss Grayling confuses sorcery with creation, she is in grave danger of corrupting your morals." "Well," said Glinda, thinking of Amma Clutch on the bed of mental pain Glinda had once imagined for her, "my morals aren't in the greatest shape to start out with, Nessa." "Then, if sorcery is to be helpful at all, it must be in reconstructing your character," said Nessa Rose firmly. "If you apply yourself in that direction, I suspect it will be all right in the end. Use your talent at sorcery. Don't be used by it." Glinda suspected that Nessa Rose might develop a knack for being witheringly superior. She winced in advance, even while taking Nessa Rose's suggestion to heart. But Elphaba said, "Glinda, that was a good question. I wish Miss Grayling had answered it. That little nightmare with the antlers looked more like magic than science to me, too. The poor Vincus fellow. Suppose we ask Dr. Nicodick next week." "Whoever would have the courage to do that?" cried Glinda. "Miss Grayling is at least ridiculous. Dr. Nicodick, with that lovable, bumbling, mumbling, incoherent way he has, he's so distinguished." At the life sciences lecture the following week, all eyes were on the new Vincus boy. He arrived early and settled himself in the balcony, about as far from the lectern as he could get. Bach had the suspicion of nomads all settled farmers possessed, but Bach had to admit that the expression in the new boy's eyes was intelligent. Averick, sliding into the seat next to Bach, said, "He's a prince, they say. A prince without a purse or a throne. A pauper noble. In his particular tribe, I mean. He stays at Ozma Towers, and his name is Fiyero. He's a real Winky, full blood. Wonder what he makes of civilization." If that was civilization last week, he must long for his own barbaric kind, said Elphaba, from the seat on the other side of Bach. "What's he wearing such silly paint for?" said Averick. "He only draws attention to himself. And that skin! I wouldn't want to have skin the color of shit." "What a thing to say!" said Elphaba. "If you ask me, that's a shitty opinion." "Oh, please," said Bach. "Let's just shut up." "I forgot, Elfie. Skin is your issue, too," said Averick. "Leave me out of this," she said. "We just had lunch, and you give me dyspepsia, Averick. You and the beans we had at lunch." "I'm changing my seat," warned Bach, but Dr. Nicodick came in just then, and the class rose to its feet in routine respect, then settled back noisily, chummily, chattering. For a few minutes, Elphaba waved her hand to get the doctor's attention, but she was sitting too far back, and he was burbling on about something else. She finally leaned over to Bach and said, "At the recess, I'll change my seat and go forward so he can see me." Then the class watched as Dr. Nicodick finished his inaudible preamble and beckoned a student to open the same door at the side of the stage
that Fiero had stumbled through the previous week. In came a boy from Three Queens, rolling a table like a tea tray. On it, crouched as if to make itself as small as possible, was a lion cub. Even from the balcony they could sense the terror of the beast. Its tail, a little whip the color of mashed peanuts, lashed back and forth, and its shoulders hunched. It had no mane to speak of yet, it was too tiny. But the tawny head twisted this way and that, as if counting the threats. It opened its mouth in a little terrified yawp, the infant form of an adult roar. All over the room hearts melted, and people said, "Aww."
"Hardly more than a kitten," said Dr. Nicodick. "I had thought to call it purr, but it shivers more often than it purrs, so I call it burr instead."
The creature looked at Dr. Nicodick and removed itself to the far edge of the trolley.
"Now the question of the morning is this," said Dr. Nicodick. "Picking up from the somewhat skewed interests of Dr. Dillamond, who mumble, mumble, who can tell me if this is an animal or an animal?"
Elphaba didn't wait to be called on. She stood up in the balcony and launched her answer out in a clear, strong voice.
"Dr. Nicodick, the question you asked was, who can tell if this is an animal or an animal? It seems to me the answer is that its mother can. Where is its mother?"
A buzz of amusement.
"Caught in the swamp of syntactical semantics, I see," said the doctor merrily.
He spoke louder, as if having only now realized that there was a balcony in the hall.
"Well done, miss. Let me rephrase the question. Will someone here venture a hypothesis as to the nature of this specimen, and give a reason for such an assessment? We see before us a beast at a tender age, long before any such beast could command language, if language were part of its makeup. Before language, assuming language, is this still an animal?"
"I repeat my question, doctor," sang out Elphaba. "This is a very young cub. Where is its mother? Why is it taken from its mother at such an early age? How even can it feed?"
"Those are impertinent questions to the academic issue at hand," said the doctor. "Still, the youthful heart bleeds easily. The mother, shall we say, died in a sadly timed explosion. Let us presume, for the sake of argument, that there was no way of telling whether the mother was a lioness or a lioness. After all, as you may have heard, some animals are going back to the wild to escape the implications of the current laws."
Elphaba sat down nonplussed. "It doesn't seem right to me," she said to Bok and Averick, "for the sake of a science lesson to drag a cub in here without its mother. Look how terrified it is. It is shivering, and it can't be cold." Other students began to venture opinions, but the doctor shot them down one by one. The point being, apparently, that without language or contextual clues, at its infant stages, a beast was not clearly animal or animal.
"This has a political implication," said Elphaba loudly. "I thought this was life sciences, not current events."
Bok and Averick shushed her. She was getting a terrible reputation as a loudmouth. The doctor dragged the episode out long after everyone had digested the point. But finally he turned and said,
"Now, do you think that if we could cauterize that part of the brain that develops language, we could eliminate the notion of pain, and thus its existence? Early tests on this little tom lion show interesting results."
He had picked up a small hammer with a rubber head and a syringe. The beast drew itself up and hissed, and then backed up and fell on the floor and streaked toward the door, which had closed and locked from this side, as it had the previous week. But it wasn't only Elphaba who was on her feet yelling. Half a dozen students were shouting at the doctor. "Pain! Eliminate pain! Look at the thing! It's terrified! It already gets pain! Don't do that! What are you, crazy?" The doctor paused, visibly tightening his grip on the mallet.
"I will not preside over such shocking refusal to learn," he said, affronted. "You are leaping to harebrained conclusions based on sentiment and no observation. Bring the beast here. Bring it back. Young lady, I insist. I shall be quite cross."
But two girls from Briscoe Hall disobeyed and ran out of the room carrying the clawing lion cub in an apron between them. The room collapsed in an uproar, and Dr. Nicodick stalked off the stage. Elphaba turned to Bok and said, "Well, I guess I don't get to ask Glinda's good question about the difference between science and sorcery, do I? We were definitely headed down a different path today." But her voice was shaking. "You felt for that beast, didn't you?" Bok was touched. "Elphi, you're trembling. I don't mean this in an insulting way, but you've nearly gone white with passion. Come on, let's sneak out and get a tea at the cafe at Railway Square for old time's sake." Perhaps every accidental cluster of people has a short period of grace in between the initial shyness and prejudice on the one hand, and eventual repugnance and betrayal on the other. For Bok, it seemed that his summer obsession with the then Glinda made sense, if only to usher in this following, more mature comfort with a circle of friends who had begun to feel inevitably and permanently connected. The boys still weren't allowed access to Craig Hall, nor the girls to the boys' schools, but the city center area of Shiz became an extension of the parlors and lecture halls in which they were allowed to mingle. On a midweek afternoon, on a weekend morning, they would meet by the canal with a bottle of wine, or in a café or student watering hole, or they would walk about and discuss the fine points of Shiz architecture, or they would laugh about the excesses of their teachers. Bok and Averick, Elphaba and Nessa Rose with Nanny, Glinda and sometimes Fanet and Shen Shen and Miller, and sometimes Crope and Tibbet. And Crope brought Fiero along and introduced him, which frosted Tibbet for a week or so, until the evening that Fiero said in his shy, formal way,
"Of course, I have been married for some time. We marry young in the Vincas."
The others were agog at the notion and felt juvenile. To be sure, Elphaba and Averick needled each other mercilessly. Nessa Rose tried everyone's patience with her religious rantings. Crope's and Tibbet's stream of saucy remarks got them dumped in the canal more than once. But Bok was relieved to find that his crush on Glinda was lifting somewhat. She sat on the edge of the picnic blanket with a look of self-reliance, and she diverted conversation away from herself. He had loved the girl who had loved the glamour in herself, and that girl seemed to have disappeared. But he was happy to have Glinda as a friend. Well, in a nutshell, he had loved Glinda, and this now was Glinda. Someone he could no longer quite figure out. Case closed. It was a charmed circle. All the girls steered clear of Madame Morrible while they could. One cold evening, however, Grammatic came hunting for the Thropp sisters. Nanny huffed and wound the strings of a fresh apron around her waist and prodded Nessa Rose and Elphaba downstairs toward the parlor of the head.
"I hate that Grammatic thing," said Nessa Rose. "However does it work, anyway? Is it clockwork, or is it magicked,
or some combination of the two.
I always imagined a bit of nonsense, that there was a dwarf inside, or an acrobatic family of elves, each working a limb, said Elphaba. Whenever Grammatic comes around, my hand gets a strange hunger for a hammer.
I can't imagine, Nessa Rose said.